Loading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber Trains, Trains, Trains. You might think of them, you might not think of them very often, but they make America run. Getting stuff from point A to point B is more than a full-time job. Our world runs on logistical supply chains that are supported in large part by freight trains. But what happens if the people doing those jobs don't get much sleep? What happens when the company running trains implements systems that deprive its already weary workforce of much-needed Z's? Here to answer that question and talk about the American train situation is Motherboard staff writer Aaron Gordon. We're going through three of his stories today. The first is the worst and most egregious attendance policy is pushing railroad workers to the brink. The other is, what choice do I have? Freight train conductors are forced to work tired, sick, and stressed. And then if we have time, we're going to get into a weird little beef about Amtrak and Twitch. So stick around for that. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on to Cyber. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Matthew, for having me.
All right, so the first and most important question is, let me be blunt, Aaron, is there a labor crisis in America today?
First of all, excellent Simpsons reference. Thank you so much for opening with that. But the answer is yes. There is absolutely a crisis going on with freight rail workers today, and it's a crisis that I think most Americans won't see because one of the kind of beauties of freight rail is that for most people, it kind of operates in the background. It just gets things from, you know, where they're going or where they're coming from to where they're going out of most people's view. And it just kind of works as far as most people are concerned. But when it doesn't work, it has really, really profound consequences, both for our economy and for our safety.
All right, well, let's do some real basic like scene setting up here at the first, because you know way more about trains than I do, and I'm going to assume most of chat as well. What exactly is getting hauled on a freight train?
The short answer is most everything that is important to our economy, but some things more than others, because, you know, obviously the economics of moving things by freight rail is different than by trucks. And so freight rail tends to move things that are very heavy or difficult to move in trucks, or that we move so much of that we like to do it in huge volumes all at once rather than, you know, in individual truckloads. So think things like grain, like automobiles, coal, oil, things like that. And another thing that's very commonly moved by freight trains are hazardous materials, because it's a much safer way, generally speaking, to move goods than trucks, which are obviously moving on America's roads, which, you know, trucks get into crashes, are subject to, you know, the whims of each individual driver. And we like to avoid putting hazardous materials on trucks as often as possible for that reason. Also moving through populated areas much more commonly, all those other cars near the trucks, you know, like to avoid that if possible. So things like fertilizer, chemicals, generally things that if they got out of the train would be a huge problem for our air, water quality, or are likely to explode, often get moved on trains as well.
All right, so what is the crew for one of these things like?
So it's two people. Generally speaking, on these freight trains, one conductor and one engineer. The engineer, basically, broadly speaking, is responsible for the actual movement of the train, and the conductor is basically there to assist, which may sound kind of vague, but the workers I talk to think it's a really important job, especially as freight trains become longer. Many of them are multiple miles long at this point. And so if there's a problem, you know, on any part of the train that's kind of far from the locomotive where the engineer is, you really probably need two people to, you know, one stay in the locomotive to, you know, continue managing the train, communicating with dispatch and all that kind of thing, and the other to actually go inspect or deal with the problem. So conductors also just kind of help out with situational awareness. You know, freight trains run 24 hours a day. A lot of times shifts are overnight traveling through, you know, completely deserted territory. It can, and freight rail, the workers on the train are not allowed to do things that truckers can do to kind of keep them awake, whether that's like, you know, listening to a book on tape or a podcast or the radio or something like that. Freight rail workers can't do that because of federal safety regulations. And so, you know, just think of being on a train in the middle of the night. You're going like 20 miles an hour. It's quiet. That train's kind of rocking you back and forth. You're in this big comfy captain's chair. Real easy to get drowsy. And so having two people there is a, you know, important safety mechanism for just keeping everybody awake and aware. So it's important for that reason too.
Right. And that kind of anecdote about being rocked gently back and forth to sleep kind of feeds into, I would say, the lead of your most recent story, which we've got linked up at the top. So what happened to the gentleman you interview at the top of this story?
Yeah, so essentially he had a busy week at work, but if you look just at, you know, and I looked at his, you know, work tickets, essentially, you know, showing his pay stubs and hours worked as part of the reporting for this story and fact checking of it. And if you just looked at the raw number of hours worked, you'd be like, he had a busy week, but not a crazy busy week. But you have to, but digging into the details, he was really, really stressed and overworked and didn't get enough sleep because of the way that freight rail schedules work. And this is, he basically had to work an overnight shift followed by a day shift followed by a day off where he was at a hotel at a terminal away from home with nothing to do, just, you know, laying there basically, and then had to go back to work and then came home, was unable to sleep, had to go back to work again. So he basically ended up averaging less than 5 hours of sleep a night for a week straight, all while kind of getting this really inconsistent sleep pattern, you know, sometimes at night, sometimes a nap during the day, not able to get these really restful sleep that you want people to get when they're working a safety critical job. And so he ended up then having to work another overnight shift with all of this terrible sleeping pattern from all week. And he found himself falling asleep on the train, essentially. He was supposed to be running it, and he caught himself falling asleep. He had taken he had taken 600 milligrams of caffeine pills to try and stay awake, which is equivalent to about 6 cups of coffee. And it wasn't good enough. You know, he just kind of fell asleep despite his own strength to try and stay awake. He couldn't help himself. And he was pretty sure that the engineer he was working with was also falling asleep too for similar reasons.
So I've got, before we really dive into what's going on here, I think that this is kind of a good thing to throw up at top that'll, I think, come up a couple different times throughout the story. Emery Lee, 2014, asks, is the compensation of these train workers commensurate with the value that they bring to the economy?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And pretty much to a person of, you know, the rail workers I've talked to for these stories, they say a pretty similar thing, which is we're paid well. You know, we make, you know, somewhere between high five figures and low six figures, depending on how much they work. And they have great benefits. And until about 5 years ago, they liked the job. You know, it had an inconsistent schedule. And many of the drawbacks that we talk about, you know, in these stories existed to a much smaller degree before. But what started happening about 5 years ago is all of the major freight rail companies, there are seven what's called class one freight rail companies, and they basically account for the vast majority of all freight rail traffic in North America. And they essentially run geographic monopolies or duopolies. They, you know, basically what happened is the government allowed them to have these geographic monopolies or duopolies in exchange for, you know, some oversight over their operations that the government is supposed to provide. And about 5 years ago, these freight rail companies decided, you know, for various reasons, that their number one goal was going to be to improve their operating ratios, which basically means their profits over any and all other concerns. And so that naturally resulted in, you know, them looking at, okay, well, where can we cut the most money from our expenses? And labor is a huge expense for them. You know, they have to pay a lot of money to the workers to keep the trains moving and keep them maintained and all that kind of stuff. So they started cutting back on maintenance. They started cutting back on workforce. And since 2017, the Class 1 railroads have lost about 33% of their workforce. One out of every three workers has left the industry either by choice or by layoffs. And it's because it's becoming an increasingly terrible place to work, because the companies are trying to squeeze as much profit out of their operations as they can, rather than trying to run a service that makes some profit, which they were doing in 2017, but also provides a fairly humane work environment. So now the upshot is, now freight rail workers still make good money. You know, they still say, yeah, the money is good, but it's not worth it anymore, because they never see their families. They have to work in these dangerous environments, and they generally just don't generally don't consider the job worth the pay anymore.
Well, let's get into what's changed in the last 5 years. As you hyper-focus on one of the companies, which is BNSF, and you look specifically at this thing called Hi-Viz. So what is Hi-Viz? How has it changed the job?
Sure. So Hi-Viz is an attendance policy, basically. What basically happened was BNSF instituted this new attendance policy starting on February 1st of this year. Before Hi-Viz, BNSF's attendance policy was complicated. It was very difficult for individual families to like even figure out how much time off the workers got. But the upshot was it averaged to basically 5 weekdays and 2 weekend days a month off, so 7 days total. But critically, if they needed extra time off for emergencies, something came up, they needed to go to a doctor, they were almost always able to make that happen through various mechanisms in the old attendance policy. But under Hi-Viz, all of that has completely changed. The way Hi-Viz works is it's a points-based system. When it got instituted, every worker got 30 points. And you lose points every time you take a day off for almost any reason. There are a few exceptions where you don't lose points for taking days off, but almost every day off that a worker would actually want to take will result in a points deduction. And the points deduction range depending on how much time you're taking off and for what reasons. But it's basically between 2 and 15 points. And the types of things that people most want to take days off for, whether it's there's a family emergency, there's an unpredictable event at home that they really need to be home for, they have to go to the doctor on fairly short notice, there's a holiday that they want to attend, any of these types of things tend to have higher points deductions in the range of like 8 to 15 points. So there's only one way to get points back. You know, so you lose points, okay, whatever. There's only one way to earn points back, and that's to be available for work for 14 consecutive days. And when I say available for work, this is different than like on call that doctors have or other types of work. We're like, yeah, you're on call, but like, you know, you probably won't get a call. That's not how it is in freight rail. If you're on call, you're almost certainly going to go to work within 24 hours. So when I say, you know, you're available for work 14 straight days, you're going to be working most of those days. And the days you aren't working, you're probably going to be held up at a hotel that's at the terminal city that you took a train to. And you're there for like probably 12 to 18 hours just waiting for, you know, to get a job back to go home. So while you're at that hotel, you can't spend time with your kids. You can't do chores at home. You know, you can't take care of anything that needs to be taken care of. It's really just kind of dead time.
Yeah, it's not really a day off. It's not really a restful period at all. You're just kind of stranded somewhere waiting to do another job to go back home, right?
Exactly. And so you work those 14 straight, or you know, you're on call for those 14 straight days. You get 4 points for that. So basically, if you take a day off unexpectedly, let's say like a kid is sick, and your spouse isn't available to watch them or something like that, you just have to stay with the kid, that would probably be somewhere between 10 and 15 points. So you'd have to work for, you know, between a month and 6 weeks straight to make up for those lost points. And so, okay, so you're eventually going to lose those 30 points probably, right?
Right.
Just working on basic math. So when you lose those 30 points, basically you get written up, an investigation gets opened on you, and you get 15 points back. So it's like, okay, now you have 15 points. If you lose those 15 points again, you get suspended for 20 days. And then if you lose those last 15 points, you're fired.
It's just like, I'm barely keeping track of it as you're explaining to me. I can't imagine like having to juggle that when it means the difference between having a job and not having a job. Amount of pressure to put on someone.
And it's even more difficult than I just explained, because like the one added element is, unlike most jobs where you have shifts, like scheduled shifts in advance that you can predict your life around, railroading has never been like that. Which, again, this was a trade-off that most of the workers I spoke to knew about before they got in the industry, and they were willing to accept that for the pay and benefits that it aligned. But what's happened more recently is when you combine the high-vis system with that unpredictability, you get a really kind of hellish zombie state of a life in which your entire life is consumed by work. Because the only way they're scheduled is it works kind of, I was thinking of how to what the best analogy here is. And it kind of works more like a taxi line or like a deli line, where you like take a number and then it goes up in the numbers and then you wait for it to call your number. So when you get off a shift, there are regulations about how many hours you have to rest before you can be available for work again. Okay, so those hours pass. Then your name goes to the bottom of what's called the board, which is just a list of the employees available for work, essentially. And as trains come in to get, that need workers, workers get taken off the board to go work those trains. You get called to work on those trains. And it goes, in order. So in theory, this should add some predictability to when you're going to work next. But the problem is the trains come in, get sent out on their runs in a very unpredictable fashion. It's basically whenever the company decides that the train is full enough to run. And so what ends up happening is the list won't move for a very long time. Then it'll suddenly move a lot, and then it won't move again. And people can find that, if they're like 9th or 10th on the list, all of a sudden they'll be 2nd, or something. And so that makes it very, very difficult to predict even just what you're going to do, when you're with your day, when your name is on the bottom of the list. And with the unpredictability of high-vis and how difficult it is to get time off, you also have workers kind of gaming the list a little bit. I hate to kind of use that phrase, but I'm just using it for ease of conversation. But what they end up doing is, if they want to take what's called a layoff or a day off and take their name entirely off the board so they won't be called in, they wait until their name gets as close to the top as possible, right? Makes common sense to maximize how much time they're getting off. But then the problem is, if you find yourself down at the bottom of the board and, 5 or 6 of the guys ahead of you are doing that thing where they're waiting till their name gets higher up to lay off, all of a sudden you're going to find yourself almost like next on the list because you had so many guys just suddenly drop off the board. So what, the upshot of this is, I talked to spouses of railroad workers, talked to railroad workers themselves, and basically they're all like, I'm glued to my phone looking at that board when I'm not at work, because it's just like, if I take, a few hours to go do something else, next thing I know, my phone will be ringing and I'll be getting called in and I'll be like, what the hell? I thought I was at the bottom of the board. So that kind of adds to the fact that like there's just the work has become the life even when they're not at work. And it's, it just adds to the stress level of the whole thing.
In previously, before the system was implemented, it also wasn't great, but there was a mechanism by which people could say like, I need 24 hours and please leave me alone for 24 hours. Right. And now that's gone.
Yeah, that's right. And there were a couple of different ways this was done, depending on the situation. Like, so I talked to one worker who was sick. He woke up sick, with what sounded like kind of a stomach bug. And, there are various ways in which under the old system, he could have taken take his name off the board for 24 hours until he felt better. And all of those ways under high vis have been taken out from under him. And I think the most telling one is, you know, there used to be a way where if, you know, even if all of the formal mechanisms couldn't be done for whatever reason, because a lot of them have become automated by algorithms that the company controls. And so you just like push a button saying, I want to lay off. And it's just like, your request has been rejected and you don't know why. So like there used to be a way to kind of override that where you would call a superintendent, a local superintendent. It was basically like a supervisor. And you'd say, you know, look, I'm just really sick. I can't work. I can't go in. And they'd override the system. And that was it. And, you know, it's like if you abuse the system, then, yeah, some alarm bells would probably get rung. But most of the time, workers could find that they called in and said, look, I'm throwing up all over the place. I can't go to work. They wouldn't have to go to work. Well, as part of implementing Hi-Viz, superintendents can no longer override those automatic rejections. And so what this worker I spoke to had to do was he had to go to work while he had a stomach bug. You know, and it's like, that's not the health level you want from someone responsible for a train that may well be carrying dozens of, you know, oil tankers, you know, or fertilizer that could poison a whole town, or, you know, just like all of these other nightmare scenarios, not to mention just more, one, that's a deeply unpleasant work environment, you know, for the workers. And two, like, you know, a lot of railroad tragedies don't involve mass catastrophes. They're just, you know, just quote unquote, one train colliding into another and two workers dying, or someone hitting a car that maybe they shouldn't have hit that was crossing the tracks, or other types of things that don't get, you know, don't make international news, but are tragedies nonetheless. And those are more likely to happen when you have guys controlling the trains who, you know, can't stop throwing up or whatever the situation is.
All right, cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. If you are listening to the podcast, we'll be right back after this. If you're watching us on Twitch, we're going to keep on going.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, cyber listeners, thank you so much for sticking around. We are on with Aaron Gordon. It is a train extravaganza episode. Aaron, chat has been asking this question a couple times now and getting into it a little bit. Are these workers unionized? What's going on? And can they push
Great
back?
Great question. yeah. So this is another, you know, this story has been so interesting to report because there are so many threads here that really talk about kind of like where we're at with the American labor world and what it's like to be a worker in America these days. And so, yes, these workers are unionized. In fact, they're represented by two unions. One of them, the BLET, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineer Trainmen, I might have messed that up, but it's BLET, is the oldest union in America. It dates back to 1863. It's the one that noted American socialist Eugene Debs was very prominent and made a name for himself in. It's intertwined with American history in so many deep and fascinating ways. The other one is called SMART-TD. It's an acronym, and I won't remember it off the top of my head, but basically it's a transportation and industrial workers union that also has a rich history in the U.S. So these workers are unionized. They currently do not have a contract. They say BNSF is not negotiating in good faith. They haven't had a contract in 3 years, which also means they haven't had any raises other kind of, you know, workplace improvement measures implemented over the last 3 years. If and when they do get a contract, those raises would probably be retroactive. But as of now, there's no evidence they're going to have a contract anytime soon. In terms of why these unions aren't protecting them from these horrible policies, the upshot is because a federal judge won't let them. The slightly longer version is freight rail workers, because of their incredibly important role in the U.S. economy, especially now during what is widely regarded as a supply chain crisis that, you know, people have different opinions on whether or not we'll ever exit this supply chain crisis. Nevertheless, there's a general recognition that we need to do everything we can to keep as much of the supply chain moving as we can. And freight rail is a hugely critical element of that. As a result, there has been a longstanding measure that the federal government can do, which is basically ban freight rail workers from taking labor action. Slowdowns, sick outs, strikes, these types of pickets, these types of things that would, you know, slow down the rail. And the idea is that it would give workers, I guess, too much leverage, because they could basically demand anything they want, and companies would give it to them because they're so critical to the supply chain. That's kind of like the theory of why these provisions are good. Anyways, when Hi-Vis was first announced and implemented, the workers immediately knew how awful this policy was, even before it was enacted. They didn't want it. They voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike. But before they could act on anything, you know, whether they were serious about striking or not, BNSF filed for a temporary restraining order from a federal judge who basically saying, don't let them do this because the legal distinction is a judge cannot issue a TRO for freight rail workers striking over a quote unquote major dispute, but they can issue a TRO for anything labeled a minor dispute. Now, the natural follow-up question is, what's the difference between a major dispute and a minor dispute? And I read the law and the judge's rulings and talked to a bunch of lawyers. And the short answer is there is no difference because a judge has never actually ruled that any dispute is major. Every dispute has always been minor. So my kind of stock answer to that is every dispute is a minor dispute until a judge says it's a major dispute. And to date, no judge has said anything is a major dispute. So there are no major disputes. In any event, the very short answer is the judge ultimately said you can't take any labor action over this Hi-Vis issue. You can't strike. You can't picket. You can't do sick outs. You can't do slowdowns. And if you do any of that, I will hold, you know, the union in contempt of court, and, you know, your union officers will go to jail. So essentially, workers are banned from doing anything about Hi-Vis, despite having a union, despite having all these worker protections, despite having this regulatory apparatus through both the Federal Railroad Administration and the Surface Transportation Board, both federal agencies that are supposedly supposed to, you know, prevent stuff like this from happening. It's happened.
Okay, it's just so bizarre to me that there's no recourse and no consequences. Well, like, there are consequences, I suppose, but it doesn't seem like there's consequences for the company. Like, what has happened to, let me ask you, I guess, what have been the knock-on effects of Hi-Vis? What has it done, A, to the labor force, from kind of a high level, if you can answer that? And then B, has it been good for BNSF?
So for the labor force question is easier to answer, so I'll just answer that. First, the short answer is a lot of people have quit, as you can probably guess. There are some numbers floating out there that upwards of 1,000 BNSF workers have quit since Hi-Vis was implemented. These are tough to verify for obvious reasons, but I will say that the workers I've spoken to talking about the kind of conditions at their specific terminals and workforces and rail yards, it seems to align with what they're seeing, which is everyone's talking about quitting every week. You know, one or two more people have left. And you add that up across the entire network, and that seems believable to me. And BNSF, you know, says they want to replace them, but, you know, their workforce, again, these numbers, which I can't say for sure are accurate or not, but they seem anecdotally to broadly reflect the state of things. You know, they've lost about on net 700 workers since Hi-Vis was put into practice. And again, this is on the backs of, or the tail end of, 5-6 years of workforce decline across the entire industry. So things are getting pretty dire in terms of workforce shortages. Now, for BNSF's perspective on this, the company basically isn't saying anything. They issue the same boilerplate statement to every media outlet, including us, that asks about it, in which they say, essentially, that they think this would have been good for workers, and they're not really sure why workers don't like it. But they're, you know, listening to the workers' concerns and will modify the policy as they see fit. As a quick aside note, they did actually modify one element of the policy up to date. Originally, workers were punished for taking time off if there was a death in the family. Now they are no longer punished. They can take those 3 days off without recourse.
Well, as long as it's there's a caveat there, right? That's only certain members of the family.
Right, right. It's immediate members of the family. It's like I can't remember the list exactly off the top of my head, but it's like mom, dad, wife, or kid is like the list. And so, you know, obviously that leaves a lot of, you know, family members that lots of people are very, very close to not on the list, where if they die, you know, you don't get any time off to not only like bereavement leave, but like to attend the funeral. Like you have to find, you know, you have to find some other way to attend the funeral. And what a lot of guys that I spoke to have had to do is just, you know, take the 15-point dock for not going to work the day of their, I think it was sister-in-law's or brother-in-law's funeral. So, yeah, it's pretty, you know, BNSF says basically that they don't understand why this is bad, why workers wouldn't like it. But the kind of broader story here, and this is one that's kind of like the fundamental tension in the industry right now, is over the direction of how much of the trains will be automated in the future and the future of this two-person crew aboard each train. Because most of the workers I talk to, and again, this is like, you know, this is the opinion, this is like the opinion of the workforce, I would say broadly. But the company has not, for obvious reasons, said any of this. Is that the company has long, you know, the class one railroads have long wanted to eliminate the conductor role from the freight rail crew and make them one person train operations. So just an engineer. And this would obviously save them a lot of money in labor costs. They say it wouldn't impact safety at all. Obviously the workers disagree. But what most of the workers I talk to say is that they think high-vis is basically a way to get so many workers to quit that then, or, you know, fired for losing all their points, that then BNSF can go to the Federal Railroad Administration and say, we can't run the trains unless you allow us to run one crew member at a time. So either the trains stop running or, you know, we can go to our one-person crews. And at that point, the FRA may say yes, because they want to keep the economy and the supply chain moving. So that's one of the prevailing theories as to why BNSF is doing this. I would much rather, you know, be able to sit here and tell you that I spoke to BNSF executives and they explained to me why they're doing this, but they're not doing that to anybody. So like they haven't said why they're doing this other than their boilerplate statement, which doesn't actually say anything at all. So we're kind of just left to go with what workers think is the case, and that's what they say. And it accords with what the Class 1 railroads have generally been doing for the last 5 to 7 years. So I don't see any particular reason to think it's not true.
Is it – what are the consequences of having a one-man crew, do you think? I mean, obviously, you know, they'll make more money, but the stuff other than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I personally think – it's hard to say for sure, because I think so much of the benefits or drawbacks on two versus one man crews is very location specific or condition specific. If you have crews that are generally, you know, engineers who are well rested, running well maintained trains along predictable routes with really good technology to act as kind of like a, you know, secondary backup safety service over and above what the engineer can do. I can totally envision a scenario in which one-person crews can be safe. But the fact of the matter is virtually everything I just described is not the case in American Class 1 railroads right now. And so I think it's a bit... I think nobody really knows how safe it would be, is my read on the situation. And, you know, I've certainly heard lots of anecdotes from workers about situations where they felt having a second person on the train saved people's lives for various reasons. You know, one of them, for example, it was, you know, like I said, these trains can be miles long now. And there was one instance where the train was crossing through a town. And in a lot of these towns in the Midwest and the West and the South, you know, like kind of like the middle of the country, a lot of the train tracks run directly through towns, like kind of splitting the town in half when a train is going through. And there was one instance where an ambulance was stuck at the cross. You know, someone had think I had a heart attack or something, and they were trying to get that person to the hospital, but the train was literally blocking the way. The town has, you know, one or two railroad crossings, and this 3-mile long train is blocking all of it. Well, the trains don't run that fast. You know, it was going to take like probably another 45 minutes for the train to get through, half hour, 45 minutes. So instead, they stopped the train, sent the conductor out to split the cars, and then moved the train forward so that the ambulance could get through. You know, and these are like, I'm sure BNSF or other Class 1 railroads are sitting there thinking, well, how often does that happen? Is that really worth, you know, like the expense of having conductors on all the trains all the time? And, you know, from a strict accounting dollars and cents figure, I'm sure they could come up with a rational argument for why it isn't, but that doesn't kind of answer the more humanitarian question, which is like, what are you really accomplishing by getting rid of this of the two-person train crews for these instances, especially when you're so profitable to begin with? It's not like BNSF or any of these other Class 1 railroads are struggling and like this is a matter of we either get rid of these workers on these trains or we, you know, run out of money and go bankrupt. Like BNSF announced record profits last year. You know, they made like $8 billion, I think it was. So, and, you know, it's just, so it's like, it's not just the individual question of, is it really worth it on a dollars and cents level? It's also kind of the broader question of what are we really accomplishing as a society by getting, you know, if we were to get rid of the second person from the crew, and is that really in society's best interest? You know, and is there a role for the regulatory state to step in and say, you're, you know, BNSF, you're granted this monopoly over your, you know, service area to, you know, make lots of money. And as part of that, we're going to say you got to still employ two people per cruise because sometimes it saves lives. I don't know.
I have some questions from chat that you may not have answers to, but you're a huge train nerd, so I'm going to ask them.
Okay.
X Show 123 asks, I guess we need reference points. Like, do other countries run one-person crew, like Japan, for a start? Do you have any idea what other countries do?
Yeah, I've actually looked into this a little bit, and I haven't found any straight answers. There are, but even in the U.S., there are freight rail lines that run not only one-person crews, but entirely automated lines. But the caveat is they're short, the trains are shorter, and they're highly predictable routes. You know, like they're very isolated. They don't have curves. They don't have dangerous areas. They carry a very predictable load on the trains so that there's no weird dynamics between like the push of the rear of the train, you know, exerting undue load on the middle or the front of the train. You know, just like all these weird dynamics aren't the case. Obviously, I think a lot of listeners would know that like, you know, passenger trains run automated all over the world, including in the U.S. So that's a thing as well. But so much of what makes freight rail needing arguably two people, but certainly one person in a lot of people's mind, is the kind of unique dynamics of these very, very long trains operating in very, very remote areas, which is the case in a lot of U.S. freight rail. So that's kind of a long answer, which is to say I don't know the answer to your question, But I would also say that while international comparisons are important and we should definitely take into account when evaluating the one train person argument, there are also differentiating factors about the U.S. freight rail climate specifically. And one of those things is we tend to run much, much longer trains here than they do in Europe freight rail.
Somebody comments, passenger trains tend to have one crew member in the cab, an engineer, and conductors throughout the train. One train in Australia that pulls iron ore is fully automated.
Yeah.
I do have another one, because I don't know what this term is. Space Jam Clam, who I think knows a lot about trains and a lot about this situation, says, positive train control is also going to be used as an argument in favor of one-person crews. What is positive train control? I have not heard of this.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for opening the positive train control can of worms.
No. What have I done?
Okay. So positive train control is, it's when I referenced earlier, like a technological system that kind of acts as a safety overseer for the engineer, I was kind of like alluding to positive train control. That's kind of what it is. And so it was enacted by act of Congress that basically freight rail had to install positive train control on their lines. And what it's intended to do is basically make sure, my understanding at least, is that it's basically intended to make sure that trains abide by speed limits. So there are posted speed limits on all freight rail tracks, and positive train control basically is trying to avoid scenarios where the train runs out of control, either because the engineer isn't paying attention, becomes incapacitated, or there are other kind of extenuating factors. And so it's kind of like, you know, if the train was on some kind of like cruise control monitoring system, you can kind of think of it that way a little bit. What it can't do is detect like obstructions in the track, or, you know, or other kinds of like more active safety measures that would be more associated with like self-driving trains, if that makes sense. And one of the other things I've heard is that from workers is that positive train control doesn't always work. And sometimes positive train control itself kind of needs some human oversight. So there's that kind of layer to things as well. It's not a perfect system. But you know, it is generally going, the commenter is absolutely right. It's definitely going to be used as an argument in favor of one person train control, because what they're basically going to be able to say is, oh, well, we don't need another human in the cab to like help the engineer, you know, stay awake or make sure they're abiding by the speed limit or whatever. Because positive train control will do that instead.
Let me throw this wrkle in here, too, from another commenter. ALBunny357 says, Class 1s hold all the data on positive train control. No independent studies have been done on Class 1, and Class 1 won't share the data. Is that true?
I believe it is, yeah. So, like, the other thing about all of this, and this is not just about positive train control, pretty much everything I've talked about so far, is you have to remember that these are private companies that are getting regulatory oversight from the federal government, that anytime the federal government wants to know anything, they basically have to go to the private companies and say, can we please have the following information? And like, yes, there are legal mechanisms for them to require that information, or for them to, you know, like basically subpoena that information. But that takes an incredibly long time. And the Class 1 railroads have incredibly good lawyers and are very good at slowing down the process, so that if they don't want to do something, it will literally take years or decades for the federal government to make them. And positive train control is not a terrible example of that. Freight rail, basically, the freight rail companies hated positive train control until they loved it. And that's like one of those things where first they heard positive train control, oh, the federal government wants us to spend all this money on this kind of like technology that won't even allow us to save any money on labor. Screw that. Like, we don't want to do that. We're going to fight it as long as we can. Then they thought maybe they could, you know, use positive train control to get rid of the conductor. And then they started to like it a little bit more and invested more in it. And now they're kind of at the point where they don't talk about how little they like positive train control anymore.
All right. Let's switch gears here. Here at the end, let's end on a maybe not positive, but a little sillier story. So this is another story that you wrote. Amtrak is streaming. Get the article up. Amtrak is streaming an empty railroad on Twitch to beef with freight rail companies. what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, so this beef is still ongoing, by the way. There's, I believe as we talk, there is a Surface Transportation Board hearing on this very beef. It's incredibly boring if you want to watch it. It's a live streaming on YouTube. But basically what's going on here is, as you may have heard, Joe Biden, our president, is very into trains. He likes Amtrak. And one of his big campaign things was he wanted Amtrak to expand service, to serve more Americans and to provide better service for Americans. And one of the routes that Amtrak has long had on its radar to fulfill that mission, and which they now have funding for thanks to the Infrastructure Act that Congress passed under Biden, is this route from Mobile, Alabama to New Orleans. And this Amtrak used to serve this route until Hurricane Katrina, when, you know, obviously the hurricane terribly damaged tracks. They stopped service and they never resumed it for various reasons. Well, they would like to resume it. And lots of people in Alabama and Louisiana would like it to be resumed as well, because they would like to ride the trains. However, the tracks are controlled by two Class 1 rail freight rail companies, and they do not want Amtrak to resume service on those tracks. Now, the way Amtrak works, for those who may only enjoy their phenomenal service and haven't dug into Amtrak's history, is basically Amtrak is a corporation chartered by the federal government that, by law, has the right to move along private freight rail tracks. And in fact, is supposed to be given priority on those tracks over freight rail trains. But in practice, this almost never happens because, kind of like we were just saying earlier, freight rail companies prioritize their own trains and basically say to Congress and the federal government, if you don't like it, make us. And nobody has. So in this particular case, the freight rail companies that own the tracks and operate the tracks have said that they would need approximately $450 to $500 million to do necessary track upgrades so that Amtrak can run a combined four trains a day, two outbound and two inbound, over these tracks. And Amtrak's beef with this is basically that is not necessary to run the Amtrak service. That these freight rail companies already run so few trains over these tracks that they could easily accommodate four Amtrak trains a day. And the freight rail companies have said, well, we'll see you in court, or at least the version of court that railroads in the U.S. have, which is the Surface Transportation Board, which is why they're holding these hearings, which I alluded to earlier, to basically determine who is right. And again, going back to the fact that freight rail companies control everything, the freight rail companies did all of the studies about how much infrastructure would be needed or what the tracks can accommodate on this particular question, because that's how these things are done. They have all of the transportation demand algorithms, and they have all the necessary data to be able to answer the question of what can these tracks truly accommodate. And so what these hearings are about right now is basically who is right. You know, they're digging into the details of the modeling and they're trying to figure that out. As for the Twitch stream, again, because the freight rail companies control all the data, Amtrak basically said, we're going to set up some live cams on this track along different points along this 144-mile space of track. We'll set up the cams and we'll live Twitch them on stream, or we'll live stream them on Twitch, and we'll see how many trains you really run over these tracks a day. And the first day that they streamed, I think it was something like four or five trains across the entire day. So that's the beef, and yeah, we'll see how it unfolds.
Aaron Gordon, Aaron Gordon, thank you so much for coming on to Cyber again and walking us through all these wonderful train things. If you are watching on Twitch, please like and subscribe. Follow the channel. If you're listening on iTunes, like and subscribe. Leave a comment. It does help other people find the show. We will be back a little bit later this week with another conversation about cyber, possibly trains again. Really appreciate everyone for tuning in. Aaron, again, thank you so much for coming on. And I hope to have you back on.
I would love nothing more.
Bye, everyone. Excellent chat today. Thank you, all the train nerds that came on. See you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.